Hey, it's John Canzano. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. And thanks to all the listeners and all of our sponsors who help make the Bald-Faced Truth the number one sports radio show in Portland. Enjoy.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. John Canzano.
People don't like to hear the truth all the time. You know, people ask you questions, but they don't actually necessarily want to hear the answers.
Love him.
I mean, I like the guy. I listen to him every day.
Canzano, what's going on, man?
He's dead sexy.
I think he does a damn good job.
I'm going to be rooting for this young Portland team, which, you know, is a terrific team. You guys just have a terrific nucleus.
You pay attention to detail. That's why you're so successful.
I just think he's honest. Straightforward and to the point.
You're bringing up something that's probably the average sports fan watching the game didn't pick up on.
I'm really glad to see that someone who speaks their mind is not afraid to tell it how it is.
He's a smart guy. That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Hate him.
You don't want to give nobody a second chance.
Trump. To represent that as some sort of subterfuge by John Canzano, I would have expected far better.
He just sounds like an egotistical idiot.
He was rude, crude, and wrong.
Love to hate him.
Yo, John, I can't stand you. I can't stand you, but I come back every day to listen to the show.
Bald faith truth teller.
Who is he to judge?
Well, he can raise your eyebrows a lot.
I was angry. He just got my feathers that day big time. Now, from the Pac West Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth on 102.9 and 750, The Game.
I'm going to make you some promises today. On today's show, you're going to hear about the Golden State Warriors. I think making one of the great statements that's been made in the NBA season this year. Maybe in the last couple of years. They were down 15-0 to the Spurs on the road on the second of a back-to-back. They were down 27-6 against the Spurs on the road in the second game of a back-to-back and came back and won the game by double digits. We're going to talk about the Warriors and that statement with Connor Letourneau, who covers the Warriors for the San Francisco Chronicle, coming up in a couple minutes. We're going to talk to Tyson Alger. That's another promise. He covers the Oregon Ducks basketball team. He'll join us from Phoenix. You're going to hear from the Sun of one of the 1939 Tall Furs. Remember the Tall Furs? They won the national championship in 1939. The first ever NCAA tournament championship was won by the 1939 Tall Furs. One of the sons, one of the children of one of those Tall Furs has something to share. And I've been looking for a connection to the Tall Furs because, let's face it, these guys were in their late teens or early 20s in 1939. And they also, you know, at this point, we're talking about, you know, guys that would be near, you know, probably what, nearing 100 years old if they were around 98 to 101 years old, if they were around. And so as you begin to look around, you begin to wonder, like, are we losing a connection with these Tall Furs? Do you even remember? Do you remember that they won an 8-team tournament? Do you know what they got when they won the tournament as the prize? I was surprised by this. We'll talk to one of the sons coming up. 8 of the kids were from the state of Oregon. 3 from the state of Washington. Nowhere else. 5 of the kids were from Astoria. 5 of the 11 members of the 1939 national championship team came from tiny little Astoria. Kindergarten cop. Yes, that's what most of you know Astoria for. Yes, there was the heartland of the 1939 championship came from Astoria. 5 kids. We'll talk about it on today's show. You'll hear from one of the sons of the Tall Furs. So what does that make him? If the Tall Furs had kids, they would be Little Furs. So it would be one of the Little Furs is going to come on the show and talk about what Dad did in the 39 championship and share memories of that. I think it's an important interview. We'll do that. I also I promise you, you'll laugh on today's show. I promise you, you'll probably get angry. I promise you, you'll probably want to pick up the phone and call me and share your opinion. 417-7575. We start today's show how we start every show.
Three random things.
Let's start with those Warriors. Wasn't that something to see last night as the Golden State Warriors were down in this game? And I tweeted this last night. I took a screenshot early in this game. It was 15-0 to start. It was 26-7 with 3 minutes and 53 seconds left to go in the first half. It was an absolute statement. And Gliss, I want to ask you, because you're our resident Blazer hunk, how much of a statement was this by the Golden State Warriors? I think this was big.
Yeah, I think it was big, and they had a big statement the previous night at Houston as well. I mean, it's clear that even though they had a pretty tough schedule the last couple weeks, that they were looking to make a statement against some of the better teams in the top half of the Western Conference.
Here's how it sounded.
Klay Thompson dribbles on Ginobili, backs up, takes West as a screen to the right side, behind the back to West. West holds it back to Klay, takes a three over Ginobili, and knocked it down again. Klay Thompson with another three.
They just keep coming at you. It's been suggested that when Kevin Durant comes back, that might be the best chance that the Spurs have of, you know, regaining the foothold as the best team in the Western Conference. The Warriors, like all good teams do, figured out and they find a way. And they are now humming and clicking as they were a year ago. Here's more sound from last night.
Curry throws into West. West wheeled it up top to Draymond Green. Back to Curry. Double team. Back to Draymond. Shot clock at 15. Curry drives by Aldridge. Down the lane to the rim. Left hand! Curry with the offhand scores. Gasol was right there. He couldn't get to it in time. Warriors up 11. Curry's got 29.
Last night, the Warriors trailed by 22. The Oklahoma City Thunder trailed by 21. It was the first time this season that multiple teams overcame 20-point deficits to win games in the same day. And if that ain't random, I don't know what is. Steve Kerr talked about how this team did not panic. They were down big in the first quarter.
That's a hard thing to do, is to defend at that level for 48 minutes. And so we just wanted to continue to move the ball and drive it and move it on and make them have to defend rather than just one pass. Let's make them defend three or four and get them on the move a little bit. And I thought we did a better job of that after the first quarter.
Kerr, he's done a great job with this group. I think it's an incredibly challenging thing when you have a team that is super talented. You add in Kevin Durant, then you take away Kevin Durant. And Steve Kerr, you know, we already knew he's, you know, the reigning coach of the year in the Western Conference. But here's another guy I think that is going to get a whole lot of votes for what he's been through. And I know people are going to say, just like they did with Phil Jackson, you give him talent and, you know, you give him great players, they win games. That's true, but you give some guys great talent and great players, and a lot of guys get fired. And there's a line of coaches in Cleveland and Miami and Boston and other places, L.A., who have had good players and failed to get it done, failed to make it work. That's my first of my three random things. My second of my three random things relates to the interview we did on yesterday's show with the Stanford economist who came on to talk about the NFL to Vegas. But the subject very quickly turned to what? What's important to us? The NFL to Portland. Is it possible that Portland could ever position itself as a destination for an NFL team? Could we walk into City Hall chambers when the protests have died down, when the city council is ready to talk about real business, city commissioners? Can we ever propose that the NFL would work here and that the city should get involved in it? Roger Knoll studies this economically. He's a Stanford professor, a Harvard guy, and he came on yesterday's show.
You had a better chance when the Raiders and the Chargers were available, right? You could have gotten into the bidding for the Chargers. The Chargers, I think, would be better off in Portland than they would be being the second team in the same stadium the Rams are playing. But what it would take, it doesn't take a Vegas-style deal. It doesn't take $750 million for the stadium, $900 million for redoing the freeway and providing the infrastructure, plus assuming the risk on a $650 million loan. That's way over the top. Nobody has to do that much. But you would have to come up with several hundred million dollars of subsidy of one form or another. Because Portland, again, it is, as you say, one of the most attractive places that doesn't have an NFL team for an NFL team. On the other hand, it would still be below average for the NFL. And the thing to bear in mind is football stadiums do not generate enough revenue to be worth it. They're not worth $1 billion. They don't generate enough revenue to be worth it. Hence, they don't exist if there isn't a subsidy, unless you're in one of the biggest markets like L.A. or New York or something like that.
Roger Knoll, economist at Stanford, who studies such things. Here's my question to you, the listener. because you know this is a burden on a city. You know that there's an expense and a cost to bringing an NFL stadium to a city. And I know that the climate here in Portland has traditionally not been favorable for using public dollars for endeavors such as stadiums. The Delta Dome is a great example of, you know, a vote that didn't happen. This was an indoor sports venue. It was supposed to be 46,000 seats. It was supposed to have 17,000 parking spaces. It was very similar to what became the Astrodome in Houston. It was a very similar design to that. The Delta Dome was going to be built in Delta Park. This was an enclosed stadium. It was intended to attract, you know, a sports franchise, baseball, football, whatever, multi-sports facility. And here it came. This was 1963. This was going to happen. It could be expanded to 80 or 100,000 seats. So the architects, you know, drew up a plan, and a bond measure ultimately failed due in part to the sense that Portland was worried it wasn't going to be able to attract a sports franchise. And by the way, Veterans Memorial Coliseum played a role in this. And I don't know if you were around and want to weigh in on this, but it opened 5 years before this bond vote came up, and it was already hemorrhaging money. And then people were worried about traffic on I-5. They said, if you put a stadium there, it's going to get worse. You know how bad that commute is into Vancouver on I-5. But people who were in support of the Delta Dome said, look, this is going to make $800,000 profit for the tax base. It's going to attract a lot of events. It was voted down in November 1964. And that was it. November of 64. They even looked at stock for citizens like the Green Bay Packers as a potential idea for this to happen. It was going to be the largest covered stadium in the world. You know, the quote in the Oregonian of April 1964 said, it will be like the Eiffel Tower, the Empire State Building, the Golden Gate Bridge, and the Space Needle out at Delta Park. I don't know if it would have happened. Robert Holmes, who was one of the people who was in favor of this, said it would bring thousands of tourists to see a stadium. Of course, by the way, it was going to be a $25 million bond to the city, not $200 million, but $25 million. So let me ask you this. You're listening to the show. You probably love the NFL. You probably love sports. Would you vote for a bond measure now that would give a couple hundred million dollars in subsidies to a NFL team trying to build a stadium here? Would you be in favor of the city getting in the business of the NFL, even though Roger Knoll, the economist at Stanford, says it doesn't pencil out? You don't make that money back. You don't create the jobs that it supposedly creates. Because if you're in favor of that, if you're arguing that, yes, the city should be involved in this, you're either arguing that because you're passionate about football, or you're arguing it because you understand the intangible benefits of a sports franchise. And that's what I'm about. I understand that it doesn't make a ton of money. It never pencils out with the jobs that they say are going to happen. But I also think bringing a sports franchise of the NFL magnitude to a place like Portland would make Portland a bigger, better city in the eyes of outsiders. It would make people who are moving here feel better about this city. It'd make people who are here feel like we're a little bigger, a little faster, a little stronger. We'd look around the country and we would feel like Pittsburgh. I mean, Pittsburgh's a great comparison when you look at market size to what we are. Vegas is smaller than us, and they've got an NHL team and an NFL team. And we're remaining as the largest city in America that has only one major league sports franchise. Do you think the city should be involved in subsidizing sports? That's what I'm asking you at 417-7575. My third thing of my three random things goes to the Final Four. I can't forget the Final Four. This is big. And, you know, we got big guests on who are going to break down who's going to win the Final Four. We've got important interviews. We had, you know, heard from Dana Altman, and you heard from Roy Williams, and you heard from Mark Few earlier in the week. We'll play more of that. You know, these guys are all talking. Like, you know, Mark Few says, man, that Roy Williams.
No, I've had a lot of conversations with him. I consider him a friend. I always remember when I was just kind of a young head coach getting started, and you get invited on these really cool, exclusive Nike you know, head coaches basketball trips, and you know, and here are some of the iconic figures in the game. You know, he and Wanda welcomed Marcy and myself in and just treated us, you know, like we were just as important as anybody, and he's always been like that to me, and he's always been like that even with my assistant coaches.
That's Mark Few talking about Roy Williams. How about Roy Williams talking about playing in a dome?
If you've got a whole team full of seniors that have done it, you know, 3 or 4 years, they would be able to tell the underclassmen. What I say is that, hey, it's a little different, but we're going to go practice there. We're going to go shoot around there. And it's the same for the other team. So I think if it were that, and we have had some guys, and we've played in big domes before, but most of the teams there, I'm trying to remember South Carolina, what tournament that they played in, but, you know, the opening of the season, we played in Maui, which was the smallest gym you could possibly play in. But I truly believe that it's different, but it's, to me, it's only different the first couple of times you get in there. And by having a chance to practice in there and having a chance to go in and then shoot around on the day of the game, I really think that helps.
It's only different until it's not different is what Roy Williams is saying about the dome, and I agree with that. But, yeah, you got coaches talking. But what about the greatest predictor of this game? Is it possible that the Tonight Show's got it? They did the puppy predictor. They put out bowls. They let the puppies race to the bowl. They picked the national champion. Here's how it went.
Welcome to the Puppy Predictors 2017 Final Four Edition. And here's how it works. We have 9 puppies, and we have 4 bowls of kibble. One for South Carolina, Gonzaga, Oregon, and North Carolina. Whichever team's bowl gets the most puppies will be crowned the national champs. Now, let's meet the puppies. Guys, calm down. Guys, calm down. Tonight we have Ron Bell, Kyle McAdams, Mary Kennedy, Ted Mooney, Donna Braylon, Peter Winston, Roger Blaine, Lisa Armstrong, and Gary Frick Jr. Now, hey, guys. Hi, guys. Now, get ready. I want it to be a fair match, okay? Nope. No wandering around, no butt sniffing, any of that stuff, okay? You guys ready to do this? Okay, let's release the puppies. Hi guys. Oh, it's like, oh, it's Oregon. Oregon is the winner. We have a winner. Hey guys.
Oregon wins.
That's the winner right there, national champs. Oregon, congratulations. Oh, good job. You did such a great job. Oregon will be crowned the 2017 national champs. You heard it here first. Enjoy the Final Four, everybody. We'll be right back.
All right. The Tonight Show says the Oregon Ducks are going to win it. Who am I to say that they're not? David in Portland has called in. I'm sure he wants to talk NFL. David, what's up?
Yes, I just want to talk about NFL. First, John, I want to say that you're doing a great job. You've got the smartest radio show and TV show in the metro area. You're doing
a
great job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, so I grew up in the Bay Area, came up here in 1981. Hoping that we get that Delta Dome at some point, but that never happened. See, the political leaders, whether it be the mayor or the governor, never pushed it. But to bring an NFL team in here would bring the community together, neighbors, family, and friends would all come to the game. It just puts us on the map, and we need to be on the map if we want to bring more corporate locations here. So I'm a big fan of that. And also, it would solidify our rivalry with Seattle, which I think we desperately need, because some of the fans down here go back and forth whether they're going to root for the Seahawks or they're going to root for the Ducks, going back and forth. So we need a rivalry, which is super important to keep us stronger and not be a stepchild to Seattle. So
I think, I agree that there are intangible benefits. I think there are a lot of people caught up on two things. One, more taxes to subsidize a stadium while people are homeless and our schools are bad. That's a hurdle you have to get over if we want to build a stadium. And number two, like the guy on Twitter saying, he says, hey, we're trying to keep people out of Portland. Traffic already sucks enough. Keep California out. Where do you stand on the NFL to Portland? We'll find out as you can weigh in at 417-7575. Connor Letourneau of the San Francisco Chronicle also next segment. will talk to us about the Golden State Warriors' brilliant comeback win. Leave it here.
Yo, this is Aerie Spears, not Mike Tyson, and you're listening to John Condano on 750 The Game. Crunch, that's his ear.
ReflexKnees.com, that's the website you need to know about. My knees feel great. I've had three knee surgeries. I don't know if you've watched a knee surgery or video of a knee surgery. That's an invasive procedure. Before you do that, give Reflex an opportunity to show you what they can do. Stem cell treatment, platelet-rich plasma therapy. Yeah, you might think that's stuff that's only available to NBA players. Nope, you can get it right here in the Portland metropolitan area. View my case study by going to ReflexKnees.com and find out if you are a candidate for their non-surgical solutions. We've been talking about the NFL to Portland, and Mike has called in. What's up, Mike?
Hey, first of all, not building the Delta Dome was like the worst mistake ever because, like I was telling your call screener, I mean, and you can vouch for this, when you go down to a Duck game, I'll bet you probably 70 to 80% of the fans down there are from Portland. So there is no reason in the world why you couldn't fill, you know, 50,000 seats. And we have so much land out here. I mean, you could knock down PIR, which hardly ever gets used anymore, or Heron Lakes, or you can go back to the Delta Park area again. I mean, the opportunities are endless. I think Portland is just really just kind of gun shy. It's almost like too big for them to digest, but it's totally possible.
Yeah, and I think that you see it work in Nashville. You see it work in Kansas City. I think it works in Portland. The question is, could the city, a city that has been anti and, you know, has steadfastly voted down public projects unless it has to do with transportation, would it get behind a sporting endeavor? 417-7575 is the phone number. On Twitter, Woodsy says you can't even get major potholes filled here. An NFL team here is a pipe dream at best. It's a good point. Connor Letourneau, he is a beat reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. He covers the Golden State Warriors. What a dream job that is, covering that Warriors team. They were down 27-6, 15-0 in this game last night in San Antonio, and Letourneau joins us now. Where are you now?
I'm at the Oakland Airport. Just got back from San Antonio.
Welcome home.
Thanks.
What was that like to watch the start of that game last night?
It was the worst start I've seen from them all season, and they've had a couple pretty bad starts, but they were completely out of sorts on both ends of the court. They just had no life in them, and it felt like it was going to get out of hand really quickly. I think they at one point in that first quarter, they had three times as many turnovers as they had made field goals. So they had six turnovers and two made field goals. So that tells you how ugly it was, but you know, this is the type of team that can go on a run pretty quickly if you're not watching out, and that's exactly what they did. They responded in that second quarter, actually absolutely dominated in that second quarter, and were able to win pretty convincingly. So it was another testament to, A, no lead is safe in the first quarter of an NBA game, and B, the Warriors are as potent as anyone.
Do you feel like they have they had something to prove with the Houston game and the San Antonio game?
I think so, especially the San Antonio game, because, you know, they had taken care of Houston a month ago in Houston pretty convincingly, but San Antonio is the one team that's given them trouble all season, and really they're the only team that's given them trouble consistently in the Steve Kerr era. Entering April last year, they had lost 33 straight games in San Antonio. So I think people sometimes forget that, but this is a team that's really had their number, and they were the only team before last night outside of Washington, who they've only played once this season, that the Warriors hadn't beaten, and they lost those two games to the Spurs by a combined 51 points. And obviously they got a lot of flack for sitting their star players last time they were in San Antonio. So I think there was a little bit
extra motivation, and I think they felt good, getting a convincing win, especially in the manner that they did.
Connor Letourneau covers the Golden State Warriors for the San Francisco Chronicle, joining us now. There were different points of this year where we wondered how Kevin Durant was going to fit, then he gets hurt. Is this a Warriors team that has made the adjustment from that injury, very smoothly? And do you worry when Durant comes back that it causes a disruption again?
I wouldn't say it was smooth, because right after he got injured, they labored through their worst stretch in 3 or 4 years. They lost 5 of 7 games, went 2-5 during one stretch, lost 3 games in a row. And so they were really navigating life without him. And both Curry and Thompson happened to go through really bad shooting slumps at the same time. And there was some doubt starting to seep into that locker room. But, they've kind of started to figure things out the past couple weeks. Now they've won 9 in a row, most of those in dominant fashion. And they're looking like the Warriors team of old. Curry and Thompson have played great. Green has been that defensive stopper that you expect him to be night in and night out. And then they've gotten some really good production from their bench. Andre Iguodala has been phenomenal. He's looked like the Andre Iguodala from the 2015 NBA Finals. And David West has been sensational too. So right now they're looking great, and I think this is only going to make them stronger when Durant does get back, because Durant's going to be rested, and they're going to know that they can win with or without him. So I think they're in a good spot entering this stretch run.
The Blazer fans who are sitting in the 8th spot, this franchise, are looking up at 1 and 2, and I don't know if they were hoping for the Spurs or the Warriors in a first-round series. Are the Warriors at all cognizant of what's going on in the race for 8?
I asked Steve about that a couple days ago, and he said he's not paying attention to it at all. There's no point in worrying about matchups at this point. They just want to officially lock up that 1 seed, which after last night, they're in a really good spot to do that. They're up 3.5 games on San Antonio with only 7 regular season games left, and I know that Portland, I think I saw 538 had them at like a 92% chance now of locking up that 8th spot after that big win over Denver. So they're not too worried about it yet. I personally, as a beat writer, have been following it, and I've been pretty impressed by how different that Portland team looks with Nurkic. Portland hasn't given the Warriors much trouble this season, but I think with Nurkic in there, they could at least give them some problems.
Yeah, let's dive deeper on that. The places and spots where the Warriors have been vulnerable, I mean, there's a team that's lost 14 games. I mean, it's tough to say they're vulnerable at all. But what has given them problems when they have problems?
With the Warriors?
Yeah.
It's been – a lot of it's been them being their own worst enemy.
Yeah.
Though their big issue this season has been fourth quarter execution. And they'll just deviate from their blueprint. Obviously, this is a team that's built on spreading the ball, making extra pass, that really selfless style of play. And in the fourth quarters and down the stretch of games this season, they've kind of given way to ISO. A lot of times they would just stand around and watch Kevin Durant, and that's really hurt them. And it is a big reason they've given up some big leads. Also, in games that they've lost, they get sloppy with the ball. They have a lot of turnovers, and they get out-rebounded. Now, if you look over at their overall numbers in the season, they're a pretty good team in terms of protecting the ball and rebounding. But in their losses, that's kind of where they deviate from what they do well.
Connor Letourneau, formerly of the Oregonian, now working for the San Francisco Chronicle. He covers the Golden State Warriors. What's the difference for you in covering the Warriors versus, like, what you were on at the Oregonian? You were on Oregon State. What's the difference for you as you approach those things?
You know, there's obviously some obvious differences. The competition's a little different. The media scrums, the Warriors are a little bit more crowded at the media scrums at the Oregon State basketball games. But I tell everyone that my biggest surprise being on this beat is that the transition wasn't as immense as I necessarily thought, because all beats on a basic level are the same. If you can cover Oregon State well, if you can cover Cal well, if you can cover
high schools well, you can cover anything well. So you just gotta have to have that same approach, which is what I've done on this beat.
Connor, the Warriors now, they get this win over the Spurs. I don't expect the Spurs to be fazed by this, but what was the reaction in the Spurs locker room and with Greg Popovich last night?
Yeah, I wasn't in there, but they never get too high or too low. They tipped their hat to the Warriors and were kind of like, let's move on. That's part of why that Spurs team is great and why Greg Popovich is one of the best, if not the best, NBA head coach of all time. He never seems to panic. They know how good they are. They know they'll probably face the Warriors again. I think ESPN right now has a 62% chance the Warriors facing the Spurs in the Western Conference Finals. So they know that that's what really matters, not last night. And the difference between the one or two seed isn't a make or break deal. So they seem to handle it pretty well.
Is there a team that you see anywhere in the West besides the Spurs that, as a beat writer, you go, well, that could be an interesting matchup if it got to that? Or is this really just a two-team race?
I mean, if you're talking about a team that can beat them in a seven-game series, I think the only team in the Western Conference is the Spurs. In terms of teams making it interesting, you know, maybe extending it to five, six, seven games, I think the Grizzlies are a tough matchup for the Warriors. If you look at the games they've had against them, they've lost twice this season already to the Grizzlies. The Grizzlies are the only team outside of the Spurs that have done that this 2013-14 season. And their gritty style, Zach Randolph gives them a ton of problems, as I know Portland fans are very aware of what he does well. And just their gritty style, the way they attack the boards, the way Tony Allen locks up Klay Thompson and those guys defensively, has given them trouble. So I think if that was maybe a second-round matchup, that would be really intriguing. But I don't see anyone other than the Spurs actually having a chance to beat them in a seven-game series.
All right, Connor, I wish you the best, and I hope I'm rooting for the Warriors Blazers so I get a chance to hang out with you a little bit and see you. It's great to hear your voice and to hear that you're doing well.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm hoping to head home too, so that would be very interesting.
By the way, what do you think of the Final Four and the Oregon Ducks sitting in the mix of that?
I'm happy for them. I mean, it's pretty amazing. You know, obviously, when I was on the Oregon State teams, when everything happened in that program with the sexual assault, and it looked like Altman might be fired, and here they are a few years later. I mean, it's insane to me, but you know, good for them, and they have a really good team. And the fact that they've overcome Chris Boucher's injury is impressive.
Are you surprised that Wayne Tinkle things went how they went for him this year? You got close to that program.
Yeah, I talked to him recently, actually. I was really surprised that they regressed in the manner that they regressed this season. But you know, there's obviously reasons for it. Trace Tinkle getting injured was a huge blow. They just didn't have a lot of depth. They obviously missed on a couple of those JUCO recruits. I talked to Tinkle last week, and he was confident that they would that they'd be able to get to the top half of the conference next season. Obviously, I don't think he thought that Drew Eubanks would be serious about maybe going to the NBA draft.
Is he an NBA player? Is he an NBA player, or is he going to get told, hey, you're not ready?
I was telling my successor on the beat, Danny Moran, that he, in my opinion, is a guy I can see maybe getting someone taking a second-round flyer on him just because he is so athletic and he has a really nice skill set. But he's so raw that I don't see him. I could see him in the D League for a couple years and then just kind of having to go overseas after a while. He's not a guy that is ready to play in the NBA in the next couple years, which anyone that's a fringe guy like that, I would highly recommend they stay in school and just get better and not worry about it until they can actually play in the NBA. Because you know how the NBA is, the guys don't. Teams aren't that patient, especially a guy they take in the second round. So I would recommend that he stay
That's
at Oregon State.
That's kind of how I see Dylan Brooks at Oregon, too. And I know people are going to go nuts, and they're going to say, the guy's in a Final Four, but he's not long, and he's not particularly athletic. And I'm wondering where he fits in the NBA. I think there are just a ton of guys that play his position that are more athletic, and they're longer than him. So if I'm whispering in his ear, I say, yeah, I declare for the draft, see what you can do, but you may be, you know, you may pull back and end up back at Oregon.
Yeah, I read an article recently that compared him to Draymond Green, which I thought was a bit of a leap because of his versatility. And I can kind of see that argument, but I agree with you in that if you're a guy who isn't definitely a first rounder, a guy who isn't going to come in and make an impact, there's no point in leaving. I mean, the difference between going in the second round and going on undrafted, it really isn't a big difference. In fact, it's almost better sometimes to go undrafted and kind of pick who you sign with. So I don't see the upside for someone like Dylan Brooks leaving to be an early second round draft pick. You know what I mean? I would say, you know, cement your legacy at Oregon, go down as one of the greatest players in Ducks history, and then worry about it. But I know it's hard when you're in that situation to look at it that way.
I appreciate you, Connor. I will see you down the road. Thanks for making time for us.
All right. Thanks, man.
There's Connor Letourneau, the San Francisco Chronicle. I'll podcast that on SoundCloud and iTunes. Make sure you're subscribed to the Bald Faced Truth Radio Show and do what 405,000 people have done in the last year. Listen to a podcast of the BFT Radio Show on SoundCloud or iTunes. You can also get it on 102.9.thegame.com. Sorry, I just spit that out. It was 750 the game. If you go to 750thegame.com, it still redirects to 102.9thegame.com, does it not?
Yeah, I think they changed everything. The Twitter page, website, everything, I think, just gets automatically redirected.
I know the rebranding worked because when I did a North Carolina radio station, it was a Raleigh-Durham station, the guy identified me as 102.9 FM, the game's Gonzano. Like, it was, I kind of smiled because I went, oh, yeah, they're getting the FM thing. Yes, listen to us, FM, listen to us, AM, listen to the podcasts. All right, coming up, we'll have all the sound, the best sound around, plus the Tall Furs of 1939. We've got one of the sons of the Tall Furs players who's going to come on and share what they got as their prize. It will make you smile. Also, Tyson Alger of the Oregonian will join us from Phoenix, and Kiki's going to read the news coming up. OmniGuard Security, if you're in the market for a security company to come into your house and make your home secure, let OmniGuard Security show you what they can do. This is security for the modern world. So you can go to their website, OmniGuardSecurity.com. You can get a quote. You can see all their cool features. You can read the customer reviews. But I'm going to give you my customer review. A+. I feel great about this company. My home feels secure. I have total control over the security of the house. Call them today, 503-970-7147. That's 970-7147.
Something is about to happen.
BFT.
Now listen up, everyone.
Let's go. The bald-faced truth.
John Canzano.
John Canzano is on the game.
I gotta say, I love him most of the time. I think he's right on.
He's okay.
John's great.
He's a little unusual.
Live every afternoon, 12 to 3 p.m.
I hate that guy because he just never knows what he's talking about.
I think he does a damn good job.
That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Now, from the Pac West Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth on 102.9 and 750, The Game.
ReflexKnees.com. They are the experts when it comes to knees. You want somebody who's going to specialize when you're talking about your knees, right? You want somebody who's an expert. I want somebody who, this is my thing, I do knees. That's what Reflex does. I had PRP therapy. That's platelet-rich plasma therapy. You talk about the healing properties of your body versus having a surgical solution and then stem cell treatment on top of that. I go down the stairs, I'm pain-free. I run, I'm pain-free. I jump, I'm pain-free. My knees used to blow up. They used to blow up after any activity. I get swollen, and I thought, oh, that's just how it's going to be. Nope. Reflex fixed that. You can get back to life, too. Go to ReflexKnees.com to see what they can do for you. All right, we're going to play some Punch It audio coming up. You're going to hear from the son of one of the Tall Furs. 1939, the Oregon Ducks won the first ever NCAA tournament. the son of one of the Tall Furs, is going to join us coming up at 1:30. Red McNeely was a backup guard on that team. He was known for his two-handed set shot. I hear Gliss has a two-handed set shot. He also had a mean hook shot, from what I could, from what I know. He'll be joining us coming up at 1:30 to talk about that 39 championship and give you a little connection to them. Tyson Alger of the Oregonian covers the Ducks. He will join us from Phoenix. Will the Dome Stadium matter? Will the stage be too big for Oregon? Where are their heads right now? Alger will break that down for us at 2 o'clock.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Well, let's start with the Ducks. Dana Altman talking North Carolina. Now, Altman and his team, they've played Iona. They've played Michigan. They've played Rhode Island. They've played Kansas. How about Carolina? Punch it.
The matchups have been in our favor without Chris, and that changes a little bit this weekend. So we've had some perimeter-oriented teams, and now we face a team that's interior-oriented. And we're going to have to play a lot better.
Kennedy Meeks is the big problem, and I'm big, I mean big. He's 6'9", 260. I'll be curious to see how Jordan Bell operates with Meeks around him in the paint. I think foul trouble will plague one of these two teams, and it always seems to happen in these big games. And it happened to the Ducks in the Elite Eight game when they got Kansas in some foul trouble early. It changed the dimension of the game. Keep an eye on Kennedy Meeks and Jordan Bell inside. I think that is a big matchup. Dylan Brooks, still waiting for him to have a big game, too. Dana Altman talked about the emotional fire that Brooks plays with, because he's like a rhino when he runs up and down the court. He kind of puts his shoulder down and he goes. Dana Altman talked about how you balance that emotional competitiveness with his talent. You want to let him go, right, to a certain extent. Punch it.
You know, every young man's different, you know, he's got a passion for the game, and you can't strip him of that competitiveness. That's what makes him a really good player. But there is that fine line that you're always walking.
Yeah, you've got to walk that fine line, but I'm still waiting for Dylan Brooks to have a monster game. He hasn't had one in the NCAA tournament. And I think if you're ranking the star players, the star power of the Oregon Ducks, I think it's Jordan Bell, then Tyler Dorsey, or those guys could be interchangeable at 1-2, depending on how you see their roles. And I think Brooks is a distant third. He needs to step up. They need a big game from him if they're going to beat Carolina. On the other side of the bracket, Gonzaga's got South Carolina, and John Stockton, former Zag, former Bulldog, he says he's a big fan. Punch it.
I probably am. It's a little bit easier. David was the last one to play for the boys there, and that was really nerve-wracking. Now it's a little bit less so, but I still care about these kids and certainly the program, and I guess I am a little uptight watching it from up there. There's nothing I can do to help. I guess there's fortunately nothing I can do to hurt them either, except for just stand out there and hope they do well.
John Stockton rooting for his former alma mater. I would like very much to see an all-Northwest final. I'm just partial to this region. I want America to look over and go, hey, all the best basketball in America is being played in the Northwest. The Carolinas, meanwhile, are saying the same thing. I don't know who you're rooting for, but I'd like to see a Gonzaga-Oregon final. I think we can't lose if it gets to that point. Rick Barry was on the Irregular Guys yesterday, and you can hear the Irregular Guys coming up at 3 o'clock right here on 102.9 FM and 750 The Game. Rick Barry talked about the resting of NBA players. Does he get that? Or, as an old school guy, is Rick Barry fired up about it? Punch it.
My comment to the guys was, oh, yeah, I'm playing 36 minutes a game and all. I said, well, the last I checked, the game was 48, so that means you're playing 3/4 of the game, so maybe you should only get 3/4 of your salary.
Old school. Old school guy. I get it, too. And I love that Kobe came out and has been critical of the players who are resting, and Kobe's taking a fan standpoint on it. He's saying, look, you got kids who come to the arena. Maybe it's the one game they're going to see all year, and they want to see their guy, and you're going to rest? Rick Barry, though, also doesn't understand why players don't shoot underhand free throws. I know why they don't, but Rick Barry doesn't understand it. Punch it.
Yeah, I just don't understand it. I really, truly don't. I don't know what the aversion is to it. It's just a matter of doing something different. And isn't the result what really matters, whether or not your ball's going in a basket at a high rate of efficiency? And certainly if you do all the research on it, it is the most efficient way to do it.
Yeah, the most efficient way to do it is shoot underhand. You know why guys don't do it? Because other guys would make fun of them. Gliss, you show up at 24-Hour Fitness, and we go, all right, first five to make their free throws are on the team. You start shooting underhand, we're all laughing at you.
Yeah, but if you make it, how can guys make fun of you? I believe his son, I think he plays for Florida, he was shooting underhanded free throws, and he wasn't missing many of them.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, I just think it's a man card thing. That's why guys don't do it. Klay Thompson and the Warriors had a 22-point comeback last night over the Spurs. They were down 15-0 to start this game. And he says his team wants to send a message. Punch it.
You say that, especially when you play the second and third best record teams in the NBA. You want to send a message and you play the best. And I thought we played great these last two games.
Yeah, they played great. They beat Houston in Houston. They beat San Antonio in San Antonio after being down 15 with no Kevin Durant in a back-to-back. It was a statement trip for the Warriors, who are now back home. But it wasn't the only great comeback. The Thunder were down 21 to the Magic, and Russell Westbrook turned in his 38th triple-double of the season in a 114-106 win in overtime. Punch it.
Russell strolls up the left side, now to the middle, down the lane. Kicks wing right, Oladipo, free for three, it's on the way, got it! Cha-ching, a Thunder money ball, Victor back in Orlando, welcome, young man. Thunder 107, the Magic 105, Westbrook got another triple-double, his 38, 52 points, 10 rebounds, and 10 assists, Thunder by two.
Did he just take the MVP trophy from James Harden, or is it just a lot of noise from a guy that we all know whose team isn't that good? I think that's going to be a big debate. What do you think, Hefe?
I like Westbrook. I don't think it's over yet, though, because every time you
eating,
see this,
dude?
You hear, okay, did he take it then? Did Harden take it?
Yeah. Are you eating? What are you having, lunch over there?
You caught me with some you were pretzels like, and peanut butter.
Were you not saying, hey, I got something to say?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, sorry, man. I thought what'll happen during the show for people who don't get a chance to watch the show, which is most of you, Hefe, when he's got something to say, usually puts his hand up like, yo, or Gliss, who's two rooms away from me. I know when you have something to say, Gliss, because you kind of lean forward and you got your headset on like you do now. Hefe's over there having lunch.
I do have something to say.
No
food in my mouth. What do you think James Harden is saying now that the fact that he's played all the games this season, I think Westbrook's in the same boat, should put them ahead in the MVP vote? What do you think about that idea?
I think it factors, but I think there's not a great disparity between, like, it's not like Westbrook has sat out 30 games. Look, James Harden, I would cast my vote for Harden because I think his team is better. He has done something that I didn't think he could do, in that he has changed positions essentially on this team, and he's played this point guard position. He's distributing the ball more. He is a really tough guard for anybody in the league. I mean, it's hard for me to say that Russell Westbrook's not having a record-breaking season, because I think he's four triple-doubles away from setting the record. But I'm sorry, I got to go with Harden on this one. It's close, but I'll go with James Harden. Gliss?
Yeah, I'm going with Harden as well. I mean, Westbrook, the numbers he's put up have been unbelievable. But if you look at where James Harden's team at compared to where they were last year, and like you said, I mean, this is a guy that's been kind of looked at as possibly a selfish player that wasn't very dynamic on offense. He shoots threes, he gets to the foul line, and leading the league in assists, I mean, it's just pretty incredible what he's done this year.
Yeah, I didn't think he could do it. That's
I didn't either. No,
I was like, he's going to be a point guard. Like, he's not going to pass to himself.
You know,
like the wonder. I just thought this was going to be a problem for Houston, and instead, this has turned out to be part of the reason why they are kind of dangerous. Are they dangerous?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, they're kind of like a Golden State 2.0. They don't have the talent that Golden State has, but I think that's the other part of what Houston has done, is they have shooters like Ryan Anderson and all those guys around him. So, I mean, he draws so much attention. They're going to be a difficult matchup for anyone in the playoffs, I would think.
Moving to the NFL, there are some rumors about Richard Sherman being traded. Adam Schefter of ESPN talked about it. Punch it.
I think there's been some tension there between the two sides, and Seattle has listened to some trade calls for Richard Sherman, but it doesn't sound like right now anything's going to happen. The draft is 4 weeks from tomorrow. If anything were to happen, it would be before then, but a Seahawks official just passed through here a short time ago, and he said, no, nothing's going to happen with Richard Sherman.
Look, it's a business, and Sherman's come out and said that. He's come out and said, look, I understand it's a business. It's show business, not show friends. And I grew up a 49er fan. I watched Ronnie Lott and Roger Craig have to go across the Bay Area. Jerry Rice, his window closed in San Francisco. If you are a franchise that wants to stay at the top, you have to make shrewd decisions. You have to shop your players. It's why I say to Portland, like, we are emotional when it comes to our players here in Portland. We overvalue our own guys. It's part of the detriment of this franchise. Bill Belichick in New England wins the Super Bowl. Then he starts looking around the locker room going, all right, who could I live without? Who do I have to say goodbye to at the end of this year? The Timbers won an MLS Cup 2 years ago. They're in the elevator after the parade releasing a player. Like, the news came out as they stepped off the float, they got into an elevator, and they're cutting a player loose. So, yes, it's a shrewd business. Yes, Richard Sherman should understand it, and I don't expect he goes anywhere, but they owe their fan base, they owe the organization, they owe to do their due diligence. That's what you do when you're a winning franchise. TMZ showed Brandon Marshall of the New York Giants Jay Cutler's nude photo. Now, this photo was posted by Cutler's wife, Kristen Cavallari, on Instagram. I don't know what your reaction was, if you saw Jay Cutler's backside, but Brandon Marshall had a reaction. Punch it.
What you think, man?
Please look at this.
What, any thoughts?
She didn't do this.
She did. Kristen Cavallari posted it.
Jay, what the hell are you doing? Jay Cutler. I've known you since we got drafted in 2006. What the hell are you doing? And he got to watch him.
There it is. That's a favorable reaction from Brandon Marshall, who has seen enough of Jay Cutler, I'm sure. I've also seen enough of Jay Cutler, so that's enough of that I want to see of Jay Cutler. And I used to be like, when you cover the NFL, I'm sorry, but you're in a locker room with 53 guys after the game who are all in various states of undress. And as a reporter, as you're in that locker room trying to interview people, I know that, like, it was always like, you know, give the guys some privacy, whatever. So, yeah, I don't want to go on Instagram and see Jay Cutler's backside. I just don't. Gliss, if your wife put a photo of you on Instagram like this, I have to think she had his blessing, right?
You would think so. I mean, the guy's standing out on a balcony naked, so I got to think he knew that that was a possibility, at least.
It looks like he's posing, because he's kind of in a majestic stance. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, it's like overlooking the ocean.
Yeah. It's like a Moana, like in the Disney movie Moana.
Yeah.
He looks like Maui. He's like looking out over the ocean. But if she posted a photo like that, would you be hot about it?
I don't know if I would be that upset. I don't know. I mean, like I said, if I'm standing out on a balcony naked, then you're kind of putting yourself out there at that point.
Well, there you go. You're out there, that's for sure, at that point. Hefe, your wife posts a photo of you on Instagram showing the moon there.
I'm kind of going the opposite way. I'd be pretty proud. I'd say the fact that she even likes it enough to put it on Instagram, I'm pretty happy with that, because she shouldn't. She shouldn't like it that much to put it on Instagram.
Yeah, I'm torn over this, because I think that's terribly embarrassing if you're Cutler, but I'm with you. I think he's kind of like I'm sure she said, I'm going to post this, take a look. You know, because it's gone crazy. Does it help or hurt Cutler?
I don't think anything helps Cutler. His career has hurt him so bad. I could see myself in this situation telling my wife, hey, post this and act like I didn't tell you, act like it was all, you know, hush, hush.
Yeah.
And it's getting him some good press. So
yeah. There you go. Well, there you have it. Yeah, I think I'd be upset about it. I'd be like, what are you doing? Nobody wants to see that. Okay, but you could post it. You know, that's kind of how you think it went down. All right, coming up, you're going to hear from Scott McNeely. His father, Red McNeely, was one of the Tall Furs. And if you don't know the story of the 1939 Tall Furs, they were the NCAA champions in college basketball, the University of Oregon. They had 11 members on the roster. 8 of them were from the state of Oregon. So 5 of them were from Astoria. Red McNeely was from Portland. He went to Jefferson High School. He was a 6'2 backup guard on this team. And I got an email from Jim McNeely, one of the sons of Red McNeely, who said, "Hey, have you ever seen what they won for winning the championship?" And he sent me some photographs. And then I got Scott McNeely on the phone, and I talked to Scott a little bit, and I was like, you know, could you come on and share part of what, you know, the story? For people here, can they have a connection with it? So coming up, we're going to redial Scott McNeely, and you're going to hear my interview with the son of one of the Tall Furs from 1939. If you have no other connection than, oh, I've heard of the Tall Furs, please listen to this. If you have somebody in your life who is a parent or a grandparent, please stick around, because we're going to dive deep in a way that I think we all should dive deep in our own lives. We're going to ask a son about his father's accomplishments and see what he knows about him. If you're in the market for a car, get yourself out to Gresham Ford. That's the Ford dealership with a heart. Go to GreshamFord.com. You can find them online there. Or you can go to 1999 Powell Boulevard in Gresham and check out their full line of new and used vehicles. We're driving a Ford Explorer that we got at Gresham Ford. This is a great company that does great business. GreshamFord.com.
Yes, this is Judah Friedlander, the world champion, not John Canzano. No offense, John.
If you've been paying attention at all since the Oregon Ducks made the Final Four, you know that they won the 1939 NCAA championship in basketball. The Oregon Ducks won the inaugural NCAA tournament championship. The Tall Furs, the Webfoots. We've seen the photographs of, you know, black and white photographs of these players. I've looked at the roster, and there are 8 players from the state of Oregon among the 11 players on the roster. 3 players from the state of Washington. Astoria had 5 of the 8 Oregonians on the roster. So it really just a team that we can really connect with in our portion of the country, our part of the country. The current Oregon Ducks roster has 1 player from the state of Oregon on it. And that maybe that's just the way that college basketball has evolved. But I got an interesting email, and this happens. And if you want to email me, you've got a story idea, you have something that's interesting, you can email bft@750thegame.com. But I got an interesting email. Jim McNeely. Jim McNeely sent me an email, and it had 3 photographs on it. And the photographs are of a medallion, a watch, and like a basketball charm. These were the prizes that they gave to the inaugural NCAA tournament champions. These 3 items, and they are in his family, and, you know, his dad has passed away. Red McNeely, who played on this team, was a sophomore guard, 6'2", came from Portland, and, you know, helped the Tall Furs in 1939 win a national championship. And I said to Jim, I said, "Jim, we'd love to have you on the show. We'd love to have you." And he said, "You know what? Call my brother Scott. He's the one who can better talk about Dad and all of this stuff and the artifacts." So we're dialing up Scott McNeely in Eugene, Oregon, to talk about his father, Red McNeely, who was a guard on the 1939 Oregon Ducks team. He's expecting our call.
Hello?
Hey, Scott.
Hi there.
Appreciate you making time to talk about your father, Red McNeely.
Hey.
So I get the email from your brother, and obviously he's got these amazing photos of from 1939 and these great awards, medal, a watch, another what looks like a necklace. What are your recollections? What did your dad tell you about 1939?
You know, he didn't talk or brag a lot about playing in the game. It was mentioned. We read about it some. He really didn't share a lot of stories about what went on, but you could tell he was, you know, a real proud person. And I did always see, well, the watch he wore all the time. The little basketball charm bracelet was on my mom's charm bracelet. And then the little medal, that one I don't even remember seeing. So
your dad, Red McNeely, he grew up in Portland, is that right?
Yeah, he went to Jefferson High School in Portland. And played there and was an all-league player, but then didn't go to college right away. He stayed out a couple years. And Howard Hobson recruited him playing AAU ball.
Wow. The thing that strikes me when I look at that roster is we see, you know, in today's game, they recruit from all over the country. But this was 8 kids from the state of Oregon, 3 kids from the state of Washington. Your dad was a sophomore guard on that team, went 6'2", and you know, it was the state's team. I'm sure people here were incredibly proud of it. And when you hear the story about how they traveled to the games and stuff, it was amazing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, Astoria gets, of course, a lot of the publicity with the 5 players from Astoria. And my mom grew up in Astoria, so she went to high school with them and then met my dad at college. And then he moved back to Astoria. So I grew up in Astoria with my brothers. And there was always talk of the Tall Fers.
When the NCAA tournament rolled around every year, maybe when you were a kid, did you watch games with dad? Or did he say, hey, I played in this tournament? Or at what age did you realize my dad won a national championship in the first ever NCAA tournament?
You know, it wasn't really while I was growing up with him that I realized that. It was later on, and actually when I was older and go back home or something, and he really was interested in watching the games, and that's when he showed a real interest in the finals. And he always loved to watch sports on TV, and he played for quite a few years of City League basketball and softball and that. But he did enjoy watching his TV. But he didn't talk about himself or the team that much at that time.
When he went to Oregon, what did he study?
I don't know. I think he just got a general degree. Because when he got out, he moved to Astoria. Well, he went into the war right after the... And did that, and then came back and took over my grandfather's business in Astoria.
What kind of business?
Real estate and insurance.
Nice. He, you know, I also see, like, when you Google his name, you know, games come up, and, you know, he was a good player.
He was, yes.
You remember playing basketball with him as a kid?
Oh, yeah. We would shoot baskets. We had a basket in our driveway. And he didn't like to play games because... he didn't want to be physical with us. And I know when I grew up and played in high school, I'd drive to the basket and he said, you know, stay back a little bit, stay back a little bit. And he'd sit out there and want to play horse.
Right.
And he'd do his two-hand set shot and I couldn't beat him. He just sat out there at long range and that two-hand set shot that they shot, he was very, very accurate.
Did mom and dad meet at Oregon, or how did they meet?
Yeah. They were both students at U of O at the same time.
Do you have any sense? Did mom go to the games? Was she a basketball fan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She didn't go to the finals or that. She was part of the crowd that met the train coming in, I remember. She talked about that, the big crowd waiting for them to return. So.
And I know as these guys, I mean, this is 1939, and these guys are, you know, in young part of their lives, and I see the photos. What do you think when you see the photos of Dad and this team?
Well, I watched the video of the final game, and of course, the videotapes are not anywhere clear like they were before. But it just was interesting, the style of play, and, you know, just watching... some of the shots they used, the hook shot from quite a ways away from the basket.
Yeah.
And the long, you know, two-point set shot. They really didn't work the ball into the middle as much as as they do now, especially because they had such a tall team, you know.
Yeah, you would expect that they would be an inside-out team instead of shooting a lot of set shots. But I you know, as this Oregon Ducks team heads to the Final Four on Saturday, I'm guessing you and your brother and your family will all root and kind of think of Dad.
Oh, sure, we will be. My son is also hosting a party for all the people here. I live in Eugene now, and we've had get-togethers for all the games leading up to it. And so we'll be together, and we'll be watching.
Dad, how old did Dad live to be?
He died in 94.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly how old he was. In his 70s, late 70s.
And when I first got to Oregon, I was at Mac Court one night, and John Dick was there, and somebody said, "There's John Dick who played for the Tall Furs," and I introduced myself to him, and it struck me that here was a guy who was still hanging around Oregon basketball all those years later, and he was still watching, and he was still rooting, and I thought it must have meant so much to him to win that thing and be part of it.
It did, and I know when my dad would come to Eugene when I lived here, we would go over to John Dick's house, and they would talk basketball. They were close as a group, I think. Even though my dad didn't share a lot with his sons, he was real close to the people he played with.
Now, the trophies, the watch, the necklace, or the medallion, what plans do you have for those? So those are family heirlooms now.
Yeah, my brother has kept those pretty much to himself.
Yeah. He sent me photos. Yeah.
But I have the blanket.
Oh, there's a blanket.
Yes, each player received this Pendleton blanket, green and yellow with the U of O, and I've had that. I'm not sure how many are left.
Wow.
The one I have is in excellent condition. It's shared. My daughter has it at her house and shows it there so people that come there can see it.
Yeah, there are only 11 players on this team. I'm guessing that it was just coaches, maybe, and then the players
So
you probably have something that's pretty, pretty special there, and you guys have that in your family. Hey, I really I appreciate you sharing this with us. His grandkids, how many grandkids does Dad have?
Well, my brother Jim has three children. I have two, and my younger brother has one. So
are they all kind of aware of, you know, their place in history or the family connection?
I'm sure my two are into it a lot.
That's great.
Both of them have really. We've got put pictures on the wall of my dad playing, of him sitting on the bench next to Howard Hobson. Which we all enjoy.
I think that's so important, and I know that, like, my own family history is important, and I think people are, you know, starting to grasp that now, that, you know, as I get older, I look back and I have so many questions. I just think knowing, you know, where, you know, what people in your family did or what was important to them, I think is so important to young kids and generations. So I appreciate you sharing this with us, because I think, like, the rest of our audience is really searching for some kind of connection. We hear 1939, we hear Tall Furs, maybe we see a photo, but not all of us have that connection that you have. So I really appreciate you sharing that with us, Scott.
Well, thank you. I wish I would have asked more questions when I was growing up. Now that I look at it, there's things I wish I would have known more about it, because, yeah, it is important. It was a big deal.
And when you have somebody like your dad who was so humble about it, you know, and he wasn't sitting around going, "Well, in 39 when we won, we did it this way." So that makes it even more challenging that he, you know, his humility is a gift, I'm sure. Thank you so much, Scott. I really appreciate you sharing the story and part of your family history with our listeners. I just absolutely love stuff like this. And look, if you want to see the photographs of the artifacts, you can go to my Twitter feed at John Canzano BFT. I have tweeted out a link to the column that I wrote about this as well, because I think, for me personally, my dad played professional baseball. I have so many questions for him. I have so many things that I ask him over and over and over again. And my grandfather, who, you know, along with his parents, immigrated to the United States from Italy. I have so many questions about, why did they leave Italy? Why do they do this? Where were their jobs? What were they thinking when they moved west after they immigrated through Ellis Island? Years later, when they moved west, why did they move west? Because my story's so important to me. So I encourage you, when you hear an interview like this, don't be one of these people who sits around years later going, ah, man, I wish I would have asked so many other questions. I was 13 years old and I got a video camera and I videotaped my grandfather. And, you know, he was 60 years older than me. And he gave me the life story. How did he meet grandma? Why did they move west? All, you know, step by step, play by play, all the stuff that you think's not important. I still to this day go back and I draw upon those interviews and I think, you know, I'm so glad that I have that. So if you are somebody out there who's got a story, and we all have a story, right? Like I could throw a dart into the audience right now and I could hit you. You've got a story. There's something interesting about every single one of the of you out there who's listening to this show. I could write a column about every single one of you. In fact, we should do it. I should blindly call people who are listening to the show. And I bet you I could find something compelling and interesting that is deeply connective to the rest of the audience and every single one of you out there. And it's why I always encourage people to ask questions. Ask the grandparents. If you've got grandparents that are alive or great grandparents who are alive, ask them about their story. Ask them, why did you move here? How did you get married? How did you meet? What were you thinking when? And ask those questions and get those answers on tape, or get those answers and write them down, or maybe gather when you're gathered around at the next big family outing, whether it's 4th of July or Thanksgiving or Christmas, and ask those questions in that lull in the conversation at the dinner table and watch how everybody lights up around the table. I just think it's fascinating. I'm glad I know some of my family history. I want to know so much more, and I wish, you know, I had done interviews with everybody. You know, there are still some holes in the story, but I love, and I want to thank Scott McNeely and Jim McNeely, who both were very helpful in putting that together and connecting us with the 1939 Tall Furs. Like I said, I met John Dick at Mack Court years ago, and it was just a hello in the hallway. And, man, this guy's really old. Like, you know, I had no, you know, real story. And I didn't know that it would be, you know, 15 years later that the Oregon Ducks would find themselves in a position to win possibly their second ever national championship. Now, in 39, it was a different tournament. Let's make no mistake. In 1939, this was an 8-team tournament. You had to win 3 games to win the whole thing. Yeah, winning 3 games in the current tournament gets you to the Sweet 16, correct? Yeah, 16. Yes, that's a Sweet 16 win. So you're headed to the Elite 8. So the Oregon Ducks have already, with 4 wins in this tournament, have already eclipsed what the 1939 team did in terms of sheer numbers. But again, it's about winning the tournament. And the Oregon Ducks now sit 2 games from winning this tournament, North Carolina on Saturday, and then presumably Gonzaga in a championship that would feature all Northwest teams. I'm excited to see what happens. You tell me if you got any connection to the 1939 team, if you ever met one of those guys, if you ever took a picture with one of them, if you ever had the chance to read a book about them or watch a documentary on them, tweet at me at John Canzano BFT and tell me what you know about the 39 Tall Furs. I'll retweet anybody who gives me any kind of information so we can share that with everybody else. I think it's good to have that kind of discussion when we're looking at, you know, history in our state. I think it's valuable. I think it's important. And I hope you learned something in that interview. All right, coming up, we will go to Phoenix, where Tyson Alger of the Oregonian is covering this team. I'm headed to Phoenix later today as well, and I will be checking in on tomorrow's show. Craig Burnback from KATU will be filling in on tomorrow's show, but I'll join in progress because the Ducks and North Carolina Tar Heels news conferences will fall right smack in the middle of tomorrow's show, and I will air portions of those, and I will call in and let Craig know kind of what the scene is like. So I think if you just leave it locked in here on 102.9 and 750 The Game, you are in ground zero for the NCAA tournament Final Four. And Chop and Justin Myers, the irregular guys, coming up at 3 o'clock, are already in place and will be doing their show from Radio Row. All right, leave it here. Tyson Alger of the Oregonian is up next. I'm going to ask him about Dylan Brooks, Tyler Dorsey, plus a little inside baseball. Look, the Westwood One broadcasts of the NCAA tournament. Westwood One and IMG do a vigilant job of protecting the play-by-play calls. That's why you don't hear a lot of play-by-play off the radio on other stations or other places, other venues. They protect it fiercely. But one of the things that IMG and Westwood One did with us is they put together, because we are the flagship station of the Oregon Ducks and we do carry all the NCAA tournament games, they put together a 6-minute clip of the Oregon Ducks road to the Final Four. It is a very cool listen. If you're a Duck fan, it is a very cool listen. If you are a basketball fan, if you want the hair on the back of your neck to stand up, if you want to get chills, I'm going to play that coming up in the 2 o'clock hour. I will play the Oregon Ducks trip to the Final Four. Essentially, you'll hear 5 minutes and 56 seconds of absolute butter from the NCAA tournament in the Oregon Ducks, and you aren't going to hear it anywhere else but right here on 102.9 and 750 The Game. All right, coming up, you will hear from Tyson Alger of the Oregonian. The Oregon Ducks, what are they up against when it comes to the North Carolina Tar Heels? He breaks it down next.
So I want you all to listen up. This is important stuff, all right?
John Canzano is on Sports Radio 750, The Game.
Okay. Here we go.
The bald-faced truth.
Call 503-417-7575 or 877-733-0750 or text to 64636.
Here we go in 3, 2.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth on 102.9 and 750, The Game.
Coming up, I will play the montage to the Oregon Ducks Final Four run. Or is it a montage of the Oregon Ducks Final Four run? It's probably that. Westwood One's got all the calls. Jerry Allen on the call for the Oregon Ducks. But if you want to hear how it sounds, very cool. Obviously, a lot of people... on earlier in the week when I played it, grab the podcast of it. If you want a podcast of it, just make sure that you check out SoundCloud and iTunes, and it's in there for you. You can share it with friends and do whatever you'd like with it. But the Oregon Ducks run up to the Final Four in their game on Saturday night with North Carolina. Pretty cool. It's not Jerry Allen at like Jerry Allen last season, who he's just a very emotional guy, and he knows. And I'm giving him a hard time about it when I saw him in Kansas City, but he knows how emotional he can get and how he is, and I think it's the best part of him, and it also gives you moments like this in the Elite Eight last year against Oklahoma. Do you remember what Jerry Allen sounded like when he was signing off of the broadcast? Oregon had just lost to Oklahoma.
To you, thank you is not big enough.
Hard to say goodbye. But we'll do it. Final score, Oklahoma 80. Glad I wasn't in that locker room now. I wouldn't have made it. Thanks for the season. Bye-bye. God bless everybody.
He couldn't give the Oregon score. Remember it? Oregon lost that game going away. He was very emotional also when Oregon made the BCS title game and when the Ducks made the Rose Bowl several years ago, he also got emotional. It's the best part of Jerry Allen. As a fan, you want your broadcaster to be in it with you, don't you? Well, I'll have that montage coming up. If you're a Duck fan or if you're just a basketball fan who loves highlights, you're going to love it. That'll be coming up later this hour. Tyson Alger of the Oregonian joining us now. You've been with this team since the beginning of the year. What did you see at the beginning of the year, maybe season, that the rest of us are just beginning to see?
I think just some of the kind of the resolve of this team. I think people have definitely seen that over the last couple of weeks with just some of the gritty efforts they've gone through. But, you know, if you go back to the start of the year, you know, this was a team that was without Dylan Brooks for a couple of weeks that, had a lot of expectations right at the start of the year that kind of, when they went out to that 2-2 start, they kind of fell flat a little bit after that. But, you know, kind of from that early moment, you kind of started to see a team that was able to take a punch and be able to bounce back a little bit. And I think that's something that a lot of Oregon fans have seen over the last couple of weeks is just a team that, you know, while everything hasn't necessarily been ideal, I mean, you can go from the Boucher injury to, a draw that put them in Kansas City to face Kansas. This is an Oregon team that has definitely been able to kind of reach past that and get beyond it.
They have been a favorite in most of this tournament. They were underdog in Kansas City against Kansas, but they entered this Final Four as a clear underdog. How are they wearing that role?
Yeah, I think they're fine with it. You know, I think Dylan Brooks is a guy that is absolutely motivated by, you know, kind of a chip on your shoulder, nobody believing you type of atmosphere. He feeds off of that. I mean, we saw kind of how the Ducks played in front of that crowd in Kansas. I, I don't think anyone gave them a chance in that game, and they definitely came out as the aggressor in that game, and they were able to kind of quickly silence that. So, I don't think it's unexpected for them to be the underdogs in this. But even if you go back and look through the rest of the tournament, while they were favored against Rhode Island and Iona, I think for a moment they were Michigan was favored against them. But, you know, Michigan was the team of destiny. Rhode Island was the team that was supposed to be a really bad matchup. Obviously Kansas. So this is an Oregon team that hasn't necessarily been clear favorites throughout this whole tournament.
You know, Dylan Brooks talked about this in Kansas. I want to play this clip. I didn't know this, but he said he got some pregame advice from Reggie Miller. Let's listen to him talk about it.
You know, Reggie Miller is one of the best players in the game, Hall of Famer. And, you know, you got to listen to those guys. And, you know, he's been through this so many times. And, you know, he said, you know, you got to lay it all out every game. You know, every game is your last in this. And, you know, you're fighting for everything. And, you know, he gave a lot of us, you know, advice, and you know, we went out there and took it.
That surprised you that Reggie Miller was talking to the Ducks?
Not really. I mean, if you go and watch any of these games, kind of in the pregame, a lot of times a lot of the NBA stars who were doing like the color commentary or analyst stuff, they'll go through and they'll talk to some of the players on the court. I'm not sure exactly where that interview took place, but you know, you see a lot during the Pac-12 games with Bill Walton going through and talking to players. But you know, one thing I have noticed about Brooks is, you know, he's always very receptive to taking advice from people he respects or that people have done it before. And so getting that advice of, you know, playing like it's your last game, I think obviously he's getting it from a guy like Reggie Miller, but I think it's easy to relate to that too, because of a player like Dylan Ennis, who is definitely going through his last tournament right now. And he's been through this is his sixth spring of basketball right now. So I think that the Ducks are definitely have adapted to that, you know, lay it all out on the floor mentality.
Tyson Alger covers the Oregon Ducks for the Oregonian. You can read him on Oregon Live. You should be following him on Twitter as well if you want to know what's going on in this Final Four as he covers it from Phoenix. The Dana Altman coaching job that he's done, you mentioned Brooks being out. He loses Boucher, and I expect that it's going to take them weeks to figure out how to play. They figured it out almost right away, maybe one game off the Arizona championship game of the Pac-12 tournament. The job that Dana Altman has done, what are you most impressed with?
You know, I am very impressed with how they were able to take the Boucher injury and within a week turn it around into an NCAA tournament run. But I think the seeds for that were kind of planted earlier in the season, not only with Altman creating a team that was without ego and was without players not afraid to sit the adjusted bench roles like Casey Benson and Boucher, but it was also identifying earlier in the season that Jordan Bell was going to have a bigger impact than Boucher was during the year. So last year, Boucher was the starter. Bell was on the bench. This year, they flip-flopped it. And so, yes, it definitely hurts having Boucher out, but it hasn't exactly killed their starting lineup because Boucher's been coming off the bench all year. You know, it's been pretty impressive how the team, you know, that hasn't really skipped a beat since Boucher went down. Now, the thing I'm concerned about is minutes. I'm coming out with a piece tomorrow just about how Oregon's starting five there. Everyone's playing minutes that are well beyond what they averaged during the regular season. And I think you definitely noticed during the Kansas game of just how gassed some of those players look. So it'll definitely be interesting to see whether or not Oregon has enough in the tank to get it done.
The Kennedy Meeks factor, North Carolina's got a guy that goes 6'9", 260 in the paint. Can Jordan Bell do what he did against Kansas with Meeks in there?
It's going to be definitely more of a challenge. This North Carolina team, They're definitely look like they're built from the inside out, and that guy plays a huge factor in that. It reminds me a little bit of when the Ducks were playing Stanford and some of the inside stuff they had there, and that's definitely a matchup that's given Oregon trouble over the course of the season. They, until this tournament, they hadn't been a great rebounding team, and they were definitely susceptible to letting guys beat them inside. So for as good as Jordan Bell was against Kansas, he's going to have another repeat effort because North Carolina is definitely going to bring it in there.
Tyler Dorsey has taken it up another level. I remember having a conversation with you in which we were lamenting during the Pac-12 tournament that Dorsey just kind of didn't come back this year playing better. He didn't look like he was improved, and it was disappointing throughout the regular season. Yet here comes postseason, and the guy just flips the switch. What happened?
I've been trying to figure that out, to be honest. I'm working on a Dorsey profile right now, and from a lot of people I've talked to, it's never been a talent issue with Dorsey. He's always been very talented. I just wonder if maybe he was just trying to kind of find his place and kind of find when it was right for him to attack within a lineup that had a lot of other options. You know, this has been a team that has gone through Dylan Brooks. They've gone through Chris Boucher. They're very guard heavy. Dylan Ennis likes to take his shot. But I think what you're seeing with Dorsey is a guy who is more talented than most of those guys that's finally realizing, like, hey, I don't have to sit here and wait for my turn and wait for somebody to find me for an open shot. I can definitely go out and create it on my own. And that's created a completely different player for Oregon, because not only is this a guy who can knock down a three-pointer, he's been able to do that throughout his whole career, but he's taking the ball and he's driving to the rim and definitely just opening things up for everyone else.
Here's what Dana Altman said about Dorsey in this tournament.
Tyler, I mean, the way he stepped up in the tournament was unbelievable, and he just playing with tremendous confidence, not only making plays for himself, but his teammates, and defensively he was solid, getting boards, Tyler. Oh, heck, he had 5 the second half, because he didn't have any at halftime. I jumped him about that, so... he had 5 in the second half, and when he's rebounding and playing defense, and gets involved in the whole game, that's when his offense maybe is his best. He's special, and if he relies too much just on his offense, he doesn't get totally involved in the game. And throughout the tournament, he's got really involved in the game.
If I was Bill Self at Kansas, the thing I would most regret in that loss in the Elite Eight isn't just that they didn't shoot it, that Dorsey came into the game. That's the one guy you had to stop, and they didn't stop him. I mean, he had a great game. Can Carolina stop him?
With the way he's been playing, I don't know. Carolina's definitely a little bit lengthier around the perimeter, and I think some of those threes are going to be tougher to contest. But I just feel like throughout this whole tournament, teams have still just been focused on shutting Dylan Brooks down and kind of letting Tyler Dorsey run free, and that's just not working out right now. And it's kind of it's a tough situation to guard against, because if you take off Brooks and go after Dorsey, Brooks can definitely torch you as well. So, this has definitely created an Oregon offense that is so much more dynamic than it had been at all throughout the rest of the regular season. I mean, obviously they lost Boucher, but Boucher was never really a threat, to go off for 20 points a night, every single night. And right now that's definitely the player Tyler Dorsey's turned into. So, I definitely think while Oregon's going to have its hand full with certain matchups with North Carolina, I don't really foresee Tyler Dorsey stopping right now, because after 7 games in a row of this, it no longer just seems like a trend. It kind of seems like the player he's evolved into.
Let's kick around the future. And again, we're talking to Tyson Alger of the Oregonian. He covers the Ducks men's basketball program, and you can read him on Oregon Live. Let's talk future. Who's coming back? Peyton Pritchard's coming back. Casey Benson gone. How about the rest of these guys? Tyler Dorsey, is he back or no, if you had to bet it?
If I had to bet it, oh man, that's a tough question, because I'm not sure what he's still going to hear from NBA guys. I think that, maybe they want to see it over more of a course of an entire season. So I would put maybe Dorsey at like a 50-50 still.
How about Dylan Brooks? It's been a foregone conclusion that he's gone. Is there a shot he comes back?
I thought maybe if they had lost in that game to Kansas, that maybe he would come back thinking that, hey, I want to get this team to a Final Four. But at this point, he's Pac-12 Player of the Year. He's helped get the team to a Final Four. I just don't see any point of him coming back, because I don't see his draft stock rising at all any higher than it is right now.
Jordan Bell made money against Kansas. We know that. But is he back or not?
I could still see Jordan Bell coming back, because, it's a pretty deep draft, and B, while Bell was an absolute beast in that game, I do think that he could definitely refine his offensive game. If he were to come back next season and average 15 and 10 and, 2.5 blocks a game, I think he could definitely jump right into the first round.
Is Jordan Bell the guy, like, if you're building around Troy Brown, he's a small forward. He's 6'7", 210. To me, he sort of takes the place of Dylan Brooks in a way that's really interesting. And then you expect Peyton Pritchard to step up. Is Jordan Bell the guy they need to have the big three there?
I think so. I think if they have Bell back next season, they're automatic contenders. This guy's electric, and if he's able to have a strong point guard in Pritchard, and if Brown's able to kind of replicate a little bit what Brooks does, I think Bell's kind of the missing link there.
We're talking to Tyson Alger of the Oregonian. All right, this team getting to a national championship game on Monday night, what's it mean for the program?
considering all that's happened with this program and the expectations and everything, you know, I would argue that that would be as big as anything that's ever happened on the football field for Oregon, just because with basketball, no one had expected this. I mean, go back to this team 3 years ago. There was 5,000 people filling up Matthew Knight Arena at night. Now all of a sudden they're a Final Four program on the cusp of landing the national title game. I think that's just absolutely huge. And, you know, talk about a relief for people in Eugene after a really down football season. They've had something truly remarkable this winter and spring to be able to follow along with this basketball team.
I called CBS to try to get a comment to find out what a Gonzaga Oregon final would mean to them. They didn't call. They didn't call me back, Tyson. I think that's probably says it all. They got nothing to say on that front. They need Carolina in this game, don't they, to get ratings?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, shoot, you could end up with a game of just Northwest schools, and you know, with that half the country can't pronounce correctly anyway. So.
Yeah.
I imagine CBS is definitely hoping for at least North Carolina to get in there. So, you know, the Ducks have that going against them, too.
All right. Tyson Alger of the Oregonian. Read him on Oregon Live. The Oregon Ducks play North Carolina on Saturday night. Gonzaga playing on the other side of this bracket against South Carolina. On yesterday's show, I had Gary Parrish of CBS Sports on the show, and we talked about South Carolina. And for people who are dismissing South Carolina as a legitimate contender in this four-team tournament, I want you to listen to what Gary Parrish said about South Carolina.
The great news is that, and I think this is true for South Carolina and for Oregon, they're both underdogs on Saturday, and they should be. But if you're Frank Martin, you look in your locker room and you say, okay, nobody thought we were going to be here, but we are here. And now we're playing Gonzaga. Guess what? Not many people thought they were going to be here either, even though they're a one seed. They got no, you know, more right to go ahead and do this thing than we do. Yeah, they've got good players, but so do we. I mean, I think this whole, you know, I heard somebody earlier today talk about, you know, South Carolina's just kind of pieced it together with just a bunch of guys who bought in. Sendarius Thornwell was a top 40 national recruit. P.J. Dozier was a McDonald's All-American. The rest of those guys are like, you know, borderline top 100, top 150 recruits, but they got two studs in there. And so it ain't like they're doing this with nobody. Their two best players could have reasonably played it anywhere in the country. But here's my larger point. If you're Frank Martin, you say, we've already beaten Duke. If we can beat Duke, we can beat Gonzaga. And same thing if you're Dana Altman. Okay, North Carolina is a one seed. We're not. North Carolina is the favorite. We're not. We've already beaten Kansas and Kansas City. If we can beat Kansas and Kansas City, there's nothing that says we can't beat North Carolina and Phoenix. And I think that's what makes this intriguing, because I know who I'll pick in both games. And Oregon fans should take some pleasure in the fact that I'm usually wrong. So, like, congratulations. but there's nothing that would be shocking about any result. Oregon winning in Kansas City, that was pretty surprising. South Carolina beating Duke, that was pretty surprising. Nothing that can happen this weekend will be as surprising as either one of those results.
Love what he had to say, because a lot of people are just missing South Carolina and saying, yeah, you know, look, they were playing home games. They got home games against Duke. That's why they advanced to where they are. This is a good team. And I think all these teams are well coached by the time you get here. Obviously, you see Mark Few at Gonzaga has the respect when he walks in the room, and the guy on the other side of this thing, Roy Williams at North Carolina. He's, you know, while North Carolina's been to 20 Final Fours, Roy Williams has 9 of those Final Four appearances between Kansas and North Carolina. And the players involved, maybe they've got one, you know, maybe they've got one and or two if you're the Carolina kids. But everybody else is kind of looking around a little wide-eyed. And I thought, you know, is this going to be a factor? I do think there's a first 5 minutes factor when you get into a Final Four game. But will it be a factor for Oregon, Gonzaga, and South Carolina to be getting into a Final Four game for the first time? The North Carolina kids were there last year. Is that going to be a factor? I asked Gary Parrish of CBS about that, and he had an interesting comment.
I hear that from coaches, and I suppose I'm in no, you know, a position to disagree with guys who have actually, you know, been through this thing. They do say it gets a little more comfortable the second time, you know, because all of these kids and 3 of the coaches are going to be placed in positions they've never been placed in before. Everything's bigger now. The media room, the questions, the outlets, your responsibilities, the cameras in your faces, the dome. It's a different deal. But ultimately, you know, just because you've never been there before doesn't mean you can't, you know, you can't do it. I mean, just look back to last year. You know, those Villanova kids had never been on that stage. They seemed to handle it pretty well. And so I wouldn't rule anybody out because, you know, they haven't been through this before, but Carolina has. So Carolina's got this. Let's fast forward to next season. But does Carolina maybe benefit from not only Roy being here so many different times, but those, like those players, really almost all of them, having done this exactly a year ago? I think that's an advantage on some level. How big, I'm not sure, but probably an advantage, sure.
If you're Carolina, don't you have to play to that advantage? I mean, don't, and I'm not saying there's much that you can do to make these other teams nervous, but I think you have to walk in the building knowing that you are the most confident bunch of these four teams. And if there's going to be a, hey, we're wide-eyed, we're in the final four mental letdown, I think it happens in the semifinal round versus the championship game. Because I think players, once they've been in that building, they've had a shooting game, they've had a chance to shoot around a couple times, practice three or four times, I think that then they have the opportunity by Monday night to feel comfortable in the building. But I do think that first time you're in that building, it affects some players. It doesn't affect others. The depth perception, the fact that you're in a football building, the fact that you look around and you're like, this is for the national championship, this four-team tournament. And, hey, we're here. We're in a Final Four. So I do think you have to keep an eye on that. All right, the Oregon Ducks trip to the Final Four. What does it sound like? You hear all the highlights, all the clips. If you're a Duck fan, get here. If you have a friend who's a Duck fan, tweet them, text them, tell them, get yourself to 102.9 FM or 750 AM The Game, because next I play that.
Hello, I'm John Lovitz, and you're listening to John Canzano on 750 The Game.
All right, welcome back. Katie's going to read the news coming up. I promised you that I would give you the Oregon Ducks montage created by Westwood One's calls of the Oregon Ducks run to the Final Four. I'm going to air that right towards the end of the show today. So if you are somebody who's interested in hearing that full 6-minute montage of Jerry Allen's calls and the Oregon Ducks and the quotes from the players running up to their appearance in the Final Four, I will have that coming up in just a few minutes. Kiki's going to read the news first, and then we'll jump into that montage. Oregon, as you know, takes on North Carolina Saturday. They are a underdog, 4.5-point underdog to the North Carolina Tar Heels in Saturday's semifinal. Gonzaga is 6.5-point favorite over South Carolina. I like Gonzaga. I like Oregon. I like both those teams to win the game outright. Forget the point spreads. But what do you like? Tweet at me, at John Canzano BFT. Tell me who you got playing on Monday night's national final in the NCAA tournament. All right, we've arrived at the part of the show where Kiki reads the news.
Ladies and gentlemen,
stand by for news.
This is Kiki Reads the News on the Bald-Faced Truth.
You got it. In Italy, state police foiled an elaborate plan to steal the casket of Ferrari automobile founder Enzo Ferrari. Now, this guy's been dead for 30 years, but that didn't prevent a group of 34 people from plotting to steal the casket and then turn around and blackmail the Ferrari family. So, I don't know what's up with these people.
You got to get his body back?
I mean, who does that? So, anyway, thank goodness the police got involved. 34 people are arrested, but that's a pretty hardcore thing to try to even think about doing. I can't imagine what's up with that. But
so how did they get his body? Like, how did they wanted to.
They didn't.
They wanted to.
Yeah, okay. The cops found out about it. The cops actually foiled the plan is the way that it was stated. So good for them. But 34 people were involved. So that's a pretty elaborate situation. It made me think of Ocean's 11 on steroids because you've got, you know, 34 people plotting to do this, so.
Yeah, that's a lot of folks.
Yeah.
That's going to be a lot of money.
Yeah.
I didn't know Ferrari's body would command that much.
Didn't either.
They should have went after Brady's jersey. It was an easier steal, apparently.
What's going to happen to that guy, by the way?
The guy who stole Brady's jersey?
Yeah.
I don't know. He's in trouble with the FBI. That's not trouble that you want.
No, international incident. And that's for sure.
And it's got eyeballs on it, which is worse yet. So, you know, it's like, you know, why would you rob a bank? That's, you know, because you're desperate and whatever. Mm-hmm. Why would you steal that jersey? I just want to know. I want to have a conversation with the guy. I want to know, like, what were you thinking? What were you planning to do with it? And apparently you'd done it before.
Well, see, that's the other thing. It's about you went to the cookie jar too many times. If you got away with it once, you're just extremely lucky.
In now this he's just, era.
Yeah.
Greedy. With cameras.
crazy.
That's what got him caught. Like, that's he could have done this, you know, 10 years ago, and he would have got away with it. But it's like the stupid kids nowadays who everything is, like, on Instagram, or they videotape themselves doing something stupid. I'm like, I did stupid things, too, but I didn't videotape them. I didn't have the ability to videotape them, so I look smarter, therefore, because of that.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. And in other news, a bust of Cristiano Ronaldo was just released recently at a Portugal airport. Now, the soccer superstar is obviously known for his rugged good looks. So it was kind of a surprise when they unveiled the bust, and it looks absolutely nothing like him. It looks like a very unattractive, distant relative of him. So it was pretty funny. The people there on site had a pretty good chuckle. You could tell that they were all a little underwhelmed with the quality of the work, but I did think that was pretty funny and a little bit ironic. Now, I did kind of Google a couple of other things of people with their statues and them not exactly nailing. There is one of Andy Murray standing next to his statue.
Okay.
His statue looks like he's maybe 75 and has like the biggest head ever, but I did think it was pretty funny.
Statue.
Yeah, it is. It is. So,
what do you do when they unveil a statue of you? Because they're honoring you, and you don't want to offend the artist, right? They usually bring the sculptor there, the artist, and unveil it for you. And you look over, and you're like, I'm so much better looking than that statue.
It's like the Seinfeld, the ugly baby Seinfeld, where Elaine was all upset because they kept calling... Her boyfriend at the time was calling the baby beautiful, but he also called her beautiful. So she was confused. She was like, does he really think I'm beautiful? So it reminds me a little bit of that. That's for sure. So
that's good stuff.
I know. I thought that was pretty good.
That's why you have to be careful. I remember. OK, so the Portland Beavers baseball team had a John Canzano bobblehead night once upon a time. And the Oregonian did a bobblehead in which they gave away the bobbleheads. And anybody will collect a bobblehead. You can find those at Goodwill right now if you go there for $2.99. But they, when they went to do it, I was fascinated by the process of that. I can't imagine a sculpture is any less intensive than a bobblehead. They took multiple photos of me, head, side shot, back shot. They wanted my shoulder measurements. They wanted everything for the bobblehead. And then they sent it off and they sent it back and they were able to make adjustments to it. Oh, no, his shoulders are much wider
really?
Than that, whatever. I have to think with the sculpture, like, didn't they see him? Didn't they see him in person?
Well, it's pretty funny. I mean, I don't know. If you put the two side by side, I definitely would not think that one is a representation of the other.
Be careful what you wish for with a statue.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if you are an avid concrete block smasher, you need to step up your game.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Because okay. I know there's a lot of
now
you out there.
Now we got everybody's attention.
I know there's a lot of you. I know there's a lot of you out there. But a 16-year-old recently broke the world record by smashing 111 concrete blocks with his head in 35 seconds. Now, here's why I bring this up. I think it's just very bizarre, first and foremost. Second of all, I get that it's a world record. Okay, great. But you cannot tell me that that's not doing damage to this kid.
Oh, yeah.
And we've got concussion
Roger
protocols.
Roger Goodell is somewhere going, hey, you know what? But there's no connection between concrete smashing and CTE.
That's why I'm like, I don't get it. And I feel like the Guinness people, right? Aren't they the Guinness Book of World Records? At some point, they would need to step in and say, hey, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And perhaps in the interest of safety. So I just think this is a kind of a weird thing, and I don't know where you really draw the line. And I know that the Guinness Book of World Records has historically done very bizarre and strange things. But I watched the video, and I'm baffled
by
it.
He's gonna pay for that someday.
I don't understand it. And I don't understand why his parents would allow him to do that as well. So
yeah, people get weird when it comes to attention. Here's something. A parking garage attendant here at the PacWest Center raised a question to me yesterday. He said to me, remember when Vince McMahon brought the XFL online?
Mm-hmm.
And here it was to compete with the NFL, kind of be a different league. They had some fun rules. You had players that maybe were a little more into the promotion of the game. It was supposed to be the anti-NFL. He raised the question that now that we have all these rules when it comes to head injuries, we're not really seeing contact football the way that we saw football once upon a time. He says, wouldn't the XFL work better today? Like if you had introduced it right now with the rules coming out where they're saying you can't touch a receiver downfield and, you know, if the ball is, you know, even running his route, he's a defenseless receiver and you can't, you know, blow to the head, no, you know, quarterback. What if the XFL came out and was launched now and it was like 1970s football? Would people be more into it? Would it have a better chance of success than it did back in the day where it just tried to be kind of a fun ripoff of the NFL?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think there are two viewers. There are a viewer that is like blood and guts. They love it. And then there's the people that are practical and are like, oh, wow, that was, you know, I can't remember what quarterback it was in the playoffs last year who took that shot to the chin.
Matt Moore.
Was it Matt? Yes, yeah. It was Matt Moore. Thank
Matt
you.
Matt Moore of the Dolphins, yeah.
Holy cow. And then was he out for like one play or something like that?
Yeah, he was, I mean, that was dead. Awful. I mean, yeah. He's lucky to be alive.
Yeah.
But I just wonder, because there are people who are like, football's been wussified. Football isn't football of the old days. Football, and I'm not saying they would promote, like, don't play it without helmets or anything like that. But I think if you didn't have helmets, it might be a safer game because guys wouldn't lead with their heads. Or if you took the face mask off, they wouldn't stick their face in there. But I think the XFL right now, if you had launched it now, I'd be fascinated to know, would it catch on if it didn't have all the no contact rules that the NFL has?
Yeah, that's interesting. And didn't they have a lot of ladies involved in that as well? There was a lot of it was that whole WWE, whatever.
Vince McMahon was
all over. So the other thing that's interesting too, though, about that is if you watch rugby, wow, now that is, those guys are animals.
Yeah.
I do like watching it, though. We don't get enough of it here, but I'm totally into that.
You like it.
I do.
You like that? Look at the look on your face.
Mm-hmm.
You like the rugby guys.
I do.
Out there. I have a story for you. Can I throw this at you?
Absolutely.
Because it relates to your original story where you're talking about the body of the Ferrari guy.
Yes, yes.
There's this interesting thing in Nashville, Tennessee that's going on. The Tennessee Senate passed a resolution on Monday that allowed the body of former President James Polk to be exhumed and moved to a new resting place. Now, Polk is not a sexy president. Like when we talk about Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, Polk flies under the radar. And in fact, he basically the resolution allows his body to be exhumed and moved 50 miles to Columbia to the James Polk home and museum. It was the home that he grew up in and museum. And the idea is the people are saying, look, they're just doing this to promote tourism. And because right now he's buried on the grounds of the state capitol, and there are other tourist attractions there in the Tennessee area that are bigger attractions. But people are saying that, you know, Andrew Jackson, in fact, his body is there nearby, and his body, because it's on one of the great estates there, one of the plantations, and it's a big tourist draw, gets a ton of activity. But nobody goes to see James Polk's grave.
Okay.
So if you're James Polk's family, like if you're a descendant of Polk, do you want his body on the state capitol grounds, like as an honor? Or do you want his body back home in Columbia, where was his family home, where it could be its own little tourist attraction that would be its own thing in Columbia?
Yeah, I think option two. I think you bring him home.
They're
split.
They're divided over it. Like some of the family members are on one side and the other. And apparently this week it was decided Polk's body is going back back to the family home in Columbia. So there you have it.
Interesting stuff.
Now, whose job is it to dig it up?
Yeah. And how does, like the transport, is there like a police escort or like, I wonder how that works. I kind of geek out on the logistics on the behind the scenes.
If you were a descendant, wouldn't you be curious to like be there when they exhume it?
Yeah, I think that would be.
Because you know the caskets back then were not like today where they have like a titanium capsule that people are put into.
You know what? Now that you say that, maybe I wouldn't want to be there.
I would be curious. You know, hundreds of years. Like that was to be, you know, I just would be fascinated by the whole process.
That's
whole
cool
thing.
Stuff. So you're about, we're about 48 hours from a pretty big game here. So, gosh.
This is it, man. All the activity and all the talk down in Phoenix, we've heard a lot of it on today's show, and it will continue. Tomorrow's show will be hosted by Craig Bernback from KETU, who's coming in studio to host the show. I'll join the show from Phoenix as the Ducks and North Carolina are doing their news conferences during tomorrow's show. So we're going to have a lot of sound from tomorrow's show. I'll join from the news conferences. So if you're somebody who's interested in the Final Four and the Oregon Ducks and Gonzaga, tune into tomorrow's show right here at noon on 750 The Game and 102.9 FM. Craig Bernback in as a guest host. I think he does a great job and he's funny.
One question for you. Yeah. Okay, at the end of the tournament when they're playing One Shining Moment, which duck is going to be prominent in that
It's
going to
be Tyler Dorsey. It's going to be Jordan Bell blocking shots. It's going to be those two guys.
Okay.
All right, I've been promising you all day that you're going to hear the montage of the Oregon Ducks run to the Final Four. As you've heard it right here on 750 The Game and 102.9 FM, Jerry Allen on the call. IMG put this together with the help of Westwood One, which has all the rights to the NCAA games. And here it is. Without further ado, the Oregon Ducks run to the Final Four.
Thank you, and hello, everybody, and welcome to Sacramento, California. It is time to play basketball. Oh, my gosh, here we are in the first round and ready to dance.
You know, we grow up, you know, watching college basketball, and, you know, during the conference games, you know, it's great, but, you know, March Madness is something that, you know, is special.
Oregon and Iona, the Ducks, the number three seed, will jump on their yellow uniforms and try to play the kind of basketball that got them to where they are today. Here comes Iona with an opportunity to take the lead, and the ball is stolen by Bell. Bell down court, going to go all the way up himself, finger rolls it up and in. Jordan Bell with a steal and the finish, and Oregon goes up by three. Pritchard goes all the way inside, lays it up and in. Bibby Williams with a two-hand jamaroo. First jamaroo of the ball game.
I thought the way we ended the first half and started the second half, our focus, our ball movement, making plays for each other was really good.
Oregon in the last 8 minutes outscored Iona 26-9, and Oregon leads to the half 55-37.
I think the second half started with, you know, them in a zone, and we kicked it into the high post to Dillon, and he just popped it out and got Peyton wide open three and got him going.
Works way outside, tries to go down low, gets there in the Jamaruski. Finishes hard.
You know, I feel like that, you know, we got a confident bunch. You know, guys are ready to play from 1 to 12. You know, we got confidence in each other. Well, last year, we made a great run, and we had veteran leadership. But, you know, I feel like this year, you know, we got a confident bunch thinking about one goal and one goal only.
And Oregon will win their first game in the NCAA tournament against the Iona Gales, 93-77 victory.
I've never been to the Sweet 16, and you know, during the game, I was thinking, I don't want this to be my last time with these guys. And they fought hard for me, and I'm happy for them.
Dorsey dribbles the ball, giving to Brooks. Wide open three. Yes! Finally! The Ducks are making it happen. It took them a while. Can they keep it up? Oregon up by two. Timeout, Rhode Island.
No, Tyler, Dillon, you know, all 12 of us, we worked hard for this.
Missed it. Rebound, Bell, way up to get it. Gives it outside. Dorsey, trying to drive, cut off. Will throw the ball to the corner to Brooks for three. Off the side of the rim, ball tipped out to Bell from Ennis. Bell into the corner to Dorsey for three. Yes! 46 seconds left, 18 to shoot.
I practiced that hesitation pull-up shot a lot, so in my mind, I was going there. I
thought he made a really good read on it. I yelled at him to shoot it because I saw his hands down and I saw his feet were right.
Dorsey, way up at the point, 15 to shoot.
His hands never came up and I just let it go.
Pull up, deep three. Gone!
We didn't want to go home. You know, Coach kept saying he loves coaching us, and, you know, we love each other, and, you know, we didn't want to lose, and it was just about getting stops, and we dig down and got stopped.
7 seconds. Matthews, three ball. Airballed it. It's going to go inbound, save. Oregon with it and wins the game. Oregon with it and wins the game. 75-72. Color it ugly, but color it a W.
I don't know. I think our guys get excited about playing all year, but they are definitely geared for this one. They know the importance of it.
Going to drive up top, give it down to Brooks underneath the Bell. Oh, touch pass by Brooks was perfect. Peyton to Brooks to Bell for the jamaroo. Percy at the point. Deep three. And he hits another one.
Want to win. They're competitive. You know, we got down four there. Guys could get into it, three or four, you know, they did, you know, they fought their way back, so it shows you what kind of competitive spirit they've got.
Ennis misses the free throw, Bell with a putback rebound, Jordan Bell snuck underneath and reversed it up and in, and Oregon within one, 68-67.
Fortunately, Jordan cleaned that up and put it in, and got us close again, and then Tyler hit a big basket.
Dorsey tries to go inside, leans in with a shot, lays it up and in. Dorsey down the middle, and Oregon's back on top by one. 1:04 remaining, and timeout, Michigan. Walton with 7, with 6, with 5.
Yeah, we were supposed to foul. Dillon Ennis had an opportunity there. I was a little upset that he did.
Goes right, back up, 3 on the way.
I don't know about worried. I was just watching the ball in the air, hoping it didn't go in.
No! Bell with a rebound! Game over!
And it didn't. I was happy, and I was excited for us to getting back to this Elite Eight.
It's over! Oregon's won! Oregon's moving on to the Elite Eight!
It's an unbelievable feeling. I owe these guys so much for putting us in this position.
And it's 55-37. Dorsey against Vic. Pull up. Three.
Dorsey with a three. 69-60. Minute 44 left. Oregon's going to win. The Ducks are going to the Final Four. 3.6 seconds to make it official. But you can book your tickets. Jacksonville inbound. And that's going to do it. 2-1. Final score. Final Four. Oh, they sound good together. 78 years since Oregon has had this good of a chance to win a national championship, and they will be one of four teams left.